Two personalities debating today's biggest geek topics. This is Project Nerds Versus.
Welcome, welcome, all you beautiful nerds. It is another episode of Versus from the Project Nerd Podcast Network. I am your friend, Tyler. And today, my normal adversary, Iggy, could not make it. He had better things to do, apparently, than be wrong. So we have a guest adversary tonight. Q, from many other of your Project Nerd properties, is joining us today. Q, how do you do, my man?
I am so good, and I am so excited to be your adversary for the evening. And I am prepared to be wrong. Like, I am ready. I feel like I've been preparing for it my entire life, if I'm being totally honest. Like, so many people have told me I'm wrong. It all leading up to this moment on Versus right now.
I'm curious to see how it goes, because, like, as much as Iggy and I argue about all sorts of things pop culture nerd related, for whatever reason, 90% of the time when we try to pick divisive topics for Versus, it just doesn't work, to the point where sometimes I just pick the other side so that we can argue. So hopefully between the two of us, we pick some topics that maybe will actually give Versus, give credence to the name Versus, as opposed to like, let's just talk about these five things.
Yeah. So welcome to Agreement, the podcast.
I'm going to go ahead and let the guest, as is, be a gracious host and let our guest open it up. What's our first topic for the night, my man?
Yeah, man. Boom. Dropped it right here. Writer, director, comedian Bo Burnham dropped his quarantine film special Inside on Netflix this past weekend, actually. It's already garnering critical acclaim. It's leaving fans and newcomers stunned with its hardline look at the past year through the lens of somebody honestly struggling with mental health, and also manages somehow to make that funny. That said, is quarantine content on the way out, or are people primed and in need of continued coverage of the difficult last year and a half?
I don't know. This is tricky. There has been a lot of different versions of quarantine coverage. There was some HBO did an interesting show. There was that film with Anne Hathaway and was it Chilty Ejiofor they did? Was it the
yes.
who else? And they did like the heist quarantine thing. There's been all sorts of things with it. I don't know. I think it was a moment that will be tough to. It'll be tough to not address it in various ways through media for a while, to the point where it's even you've seen weird things where people make comments on even like books and stuff that were written, like, because there's nothing more entertaining than a ridiculous Amazon review. But I have 100% seen Amazon reviews for books that came out during quarantine, because a lot of books came out during quarantine. A lot of publishers pushed books out. People are at home. They're reading it more than ever. Let's do this. And then having people write reviews like, well, it wasn't realistic. They didn't touch on this. They didn't touch on this. Friends, you realize this book was written like 3 years ago, 2 years ago, been in editing. But I don't know. I think we're going to see a little bit of both. I think there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be like, let's get escapism. Let's get as far away from this as possible. But I think this is one of those cultural touchstones that we're going to wrestle with in popular media for a long time.
Sure. So my personal take on it is this. I think there's very few... media outputs right now that are doing quarantine content well. I think Bo Burnham's special, if you haven't had the chance to see it yet, I think it was awesome. And it actually was a very kind of fresh look through that kind of lens of quarantine life over 2020. But I think for the most part, most things and specials that I've seen, you know, a bunch of sitcoms came back and did, you know, quarantine specials. I think if I see another Zoom-based television show or movie, I'm going to freak out. Like, it's one of those things where I literally have to watch. Like, that is my life. I'm working from home primarily now still, even in our, like, working towards post-COVID quarantine. And I see it all the time. So for me, I think unless they can all be, you know, a unique perspective on quarantine life, I think my personal opinion is the time has passed. Like, I wanted to see it when I was in it. Now that I'm trying to get out of it, I'm like, I'm good. I don't need to be constantly reminded.
I do need to sit down and find some time to watch this special, though, because I have had, not just you, but I've, like, one of my really good friends whose taste is impeccable has told me this is one of the greatest, like, stand-up specials he's ever seen.
Ever.
You know, greatest stand-up special period ever. Period. So
yeah,
I definitely want to check it out.
I will add that. And the only other one that I will recommend that I was blown away by was Mythic Quest on Apple TV had maybe one of the best quarantine specials I've ever seen.
So I'm a big proponent of Mythic Plus. I mean, of Mythic Quest, Raven's Banquet, first season. Yes. Second season's been really good. But yes, the two interstitial like special episodes they did during shutdown, one a quarantine specific one, and then the Everlight episode are both fantastic, and everyone should watch them. So
yes, agreed.
And we're really close to getting Ted Lasso back, so we're excited about that too.
I am very excited about that as well.
All right. Well, moving on. Next up, so a topic near and dear to our hearts: Spider-Man. Sony Pictures presidents recently stated in an interview with Variety that they will be introducing Spider-Man into their universe of spider-adjacent characters. So they've got a Morbius movie, they've got a Venom movie, none of them actually with Spider-Man, but and he's also stated that after No Way Home, it'll become more clear kind of what that means. He said, quote, "We really don't think of our 900 characters as the Spideyverse. We have a Marvel universe," end quote. So are we excited about the prospect of a Sony Marvel Cinematic Universe, or... No.
So, all right. I have some definite feelings on this. Right out of the gate, let me start with saying Venom was fine at best. I really like Tom Hardy a lot. Like, I think he's a great actor, but I've said it a million times and I'll say it again right now. He is a voice actor, and I don't mean he's a voice actor as in he provides voices for cartoon characters. I mean he is a voice first actor, meaning he bases all of his acting choices off of a voice first. And in Venom he gets to do two voices. He gets to do the Venom voice, the like gravelly Batman voice, and then he also gets to do, you know, "Hey yo, I'm Eddie Brock, New York Brooklyn voice accent." That was probably the most entertaining part of that entire movie. That said, I am genuinely more excited about Let There Be Carnage, only because, I don't know, I like Carnage as a character. I was a big Carnage comic book fan, so I'm interested. Woody Harrelson scares me. I will say that the like clown wig that he had in the stinger scene at the end of Venom 1 kind of freaked me out. All that is basically a way of me saying that I really, really enjoy what the MCU has done with Tom Holland Spider-Man. I think it's maybe one of the best incarnations of Spider-Man. You got a great Peter Parker and a great Spider-Man, which is kind of hard to come by. You usually have a trade-off of one of the other, I feel like, in the previous kind of universe movies. And so I am not very excited to see that introduced, if that's the way they go, into their universe, whatever Sony is building or failing at building over three different reboots of this movie. So no, I'm not excited about it. I'm totally fine. If they want to spin off a million like spider adjacent movies, I like that term, the Spider-Man adjacent. If they want to spin off a million of those, cool. Cause that means like maybe five of them will be awesome. But I worry that it's going to like taint what came before it if they involve Tom Holland's Spider-Man. That's my personal opinion.
Yeah, I mean, this is tricky for me because on the one hand, pre-Marvel Studios, Sony made some really good Spider-Man movies. Sony also made some really bad Spider-Man movies. So, and Sony made some other really bad just superhero movies in general. So that part is tricky. Also, everyone who's tried to copy the like MCU template has learned all the wrong things from it and done a terrible job of it. We've got the mess that has been the DC Extended Universe. We have the multiple failed attempts of Universal to start the like monster universe, the dark, you know, dark Universal universe thing. Everyone's attempts at this has failed because MCU, I mean, like they just saw Marvel making truckloads of money and said, we need to do this. But at the same time, like they've been obviously doing it regardless. And my biggest complaint when Sony announced all these movies is like so many of these characters, Venom worked as well as you could expect, but Venom, Morbius, especially Kraven, these characters barely work without Spider-Man. If anything else, they become strangely, weirdly problematic without Spider-Man. Like, Kraven in the setting of a Spider-Man comic book, if it's done well, works. Kraven by himself is not someone you would want to base an entire movie around. Sorry. Like, there's no good version of that movie. I hate to tell you. So,
well, I don't know. We're going to see.
We will see. I'm curious. I mean, I'm going to hold judgment until at least I've seen No Way Home and I've seen like where they're going with it and what they mean by like, you'll see kind of where we're moving with it. The fact that Venom already exists in this world detached from his Spider-Man origins is a little bit weird for me. At the same time, like, I am one of those kids. I am a child of the 80s and 90s. So that era of like McFarlane Spider-Man, I mean, I have a framed graded copy of an issue, one of the very first issues of Spider-Man, Venom, and Carnage right here on the cover all together for the first time right behind me. Like, Spider-Man is my guy. Venom and Carnage were big, you know, big villains in my childhood. Like, I care a lot about this. I've played the Maximum Carnage Super Nintendo game more than anyone probably alive. But we'll see. I mean, I don't have high hopes, so maybe that's for the best.
Can I posit just a theory before we move on to the next question? So my theory is this. I think this is what's going to happen. I think as a way to appease all fans, my theory, and we'll go ahead, you heard it right here on Versus First. If it happens, this is months before even a trailer has dropped. I will say this. I think it will definitely be a multiverse scenario. And what No Way Home is going to refer to is that our Tom Holland Spider-Man is essentially going to be transported in one way or another by the end of the film into whatever the new kind of new 52 DC style reboot of a universe is going to look like, where all of these movies kind of tie together. That way it unmarries it, or it divorces it from the MCU in a way that allows them to kind of play in their own sandbox with their characters and not affect what Marvel it is building. That is my theory. That way they can have these characters and they can have their Tom Holland Spider-Man and still slap Marvel's name on it, but it's not going to affect the outcome of the MCU.
And after this movie, kind of their agreement with Marvel Studios kind of is over at this point. So I'm curious. Here's the thing. I'm also happy with them to just leave live action Spider-Man alone. Keep making their weird spider adjacent character live action movies and focus all your attention on making more Into the Spider-Verse movies. Cause that's fantastic. And if you just make one of those a year, I'm totally go on board with that.
I will take infinite sequels of Into the Spider-Verse.
I will watch a Spider-Man noir movie. I will watch a Spider-Ham movie. I will 100% watch a Spider-Man 2099 movie. Just cue those up one after another. And let's just do it. I'll watch a Silk movie, Spider-Gwen movie. I don't care. Let's just do it. Do them all.
I love that. I love that. Well, speaking of things that I love, that brings us to the next question. This one is one I'm super excited about. So In the Heights is John M. Chu's tentpole movie musical adaptation of the smash hit Lin-Manuel Miranda Broadway musical. Everybody still with me? Of the same name. And it's coming out next Friday, June 11th. Early buzz is super hot on this movie, and we know that we're getting a Spielberg directed West Side Story remake. There's rumors of another Little Shop of Horrors reboot coming out with Taron Egerton and Scarlett Johansson potentially. All of that said, are we in the middle of a musical movie renaissance? Or are we still trying to climb our way out of the cat's litter box, if you will? What are your thoughts on that?
So, not unlike yourself, this is a thing near and dear to my heart. I am a sucker for a musical. I get down on some musical theater. I was in musical theater. I played Judd Fry. I played Dr. Henry Higgins. Like, I love me some musical theater. I will pontificate on the genius of putting the banjo in the room where it happened. Alex Lacamoire, maybe one of the greatest things he's ever done. Like, I will talk musical theater with you all day. At the same time, musicals translated into movies is a very hit or miss sort of thing. So, but at the same time, like, I anything, you know, like if Baz Luhrmann wants to just make more things like, you know, Moulin Rouge, I'm lining up for it and I'm watching them. I don't care. I love it. So yeah, I hope so, I guess would be the best answer I'd have.
Sure.
I'm a little bit curious about, I mean, Steven Spielberg has made it clear at this point in his life, he's just kind of doing whatever he wants for kicks. He's Steven Spielberg, he can do what he wants. Between Ready Player One and making a remake of West Side Story, you know, whatever. My only complaint about his West Side Story so far is apparently Tony is going to be played by...
Is it Ansel Elgort?
Ansel Elgort, who I like Ansel Elgort perfectly fine. I like Baby Driver. He's done some good work. Ansel Elgort, though, I don't feel like has... If you're not familiar with West Side Story, Tony, the character, is so striking, so hot, that Maria is basically willing to start a gang war, love at first sight thing. I don't know that Ansel Elgort is that man for me. I don't know that I would be willing to let people murder each other because of how attractive Ansel Elgort is. But maybe that's just me. I just don't think he has that essence that Tony needs to be, you know, a jet. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it'll be beautiful. But I am 100% on board with Mutiny Musicals. All day, every day, but they just need to be good, and you need to hire people who can actually sing. That's rule number one. Try your best not to do a Beauty and the Beast on us. I love you, but that bell was rough. I don't know. I if this is the beginning of a renaissance of movie musicals, I am 100% on board. We get little bumps and clinks, but at the same time, I also don't need movie musicals to necessarily just be remakes of classic Broadway musicals. Like, you can just write musical movies. You can also just do that. It's fine. I would say one of my top, I don't know if it's top 10 anymore, but one of my top probably 20, 30 movies of the last 20 years to this day will still be John Carney's Once, which is basically a musical. Like, it's just, you know, it's just Marketa Glova and what's his name from the Frames? I can't think of his name. Glenn Hansard. Just falling in love and singing songs. It's fantastic. Just put more music in movies. It's okay. You could do it. Do it.
I like that opinion. I'm going to agree with you. I'm not on the other side of the fence here. I love movie musicals. Love, love, love them. And I remember, you know, there have been times in kind of fits and spurts where Hollywood has been like, oh, you know what? That musical was pretty well received. Let's do another one. We can put out a couple musicals, and then eventually it'll fall off. And then Hollywood is like, oh, no musicals, man. Nobody's seeing musicals anymore. Quit making musicals. We'll go through a dry spell. Now, I will fight anyone on this. So if anybody has this is the perfect show for it. One of my favorite original musical movies that was not a play beforehand, and I'm just preparing for the boos and the hisses, is Robert Altman's Popeye, starring Robin Williams. Maybe one of my favorites. So first off, it's got amazing music, and I can't think of the artist who did it now, but he was the guy who wrote I Can't Live If Living Is Without You, Gotta Get Up. He also did Lime in the Coconut, the Witch Doctor song.
Oh, Harry Nilsson?
Yes, Harry Nilsson. He wrote all the music for it, all of it. And it's brilliant. Like, it's so good. And it's so original and so weird. I would love, and I was so glad that you said that, I would love more things like that. Like, things that, like, I would have never thought in a million years to turn Popeye into, like, they were like, let's make a live action Popeye movie. As a matter of fact, let's make it a live action musical Popeye movie. But it totally works. I don't care what anybody says. It's amazing. But I am so pumped for these musicals that we have coming. I am excited about West Side Story. I will kind of agree with you on the Ansel Elgort. I think he's too baby-faced is the problem for me. He looks like a child. And that is kind of where I'm like, I don't buy that this guy's a, like, tough, you know, street gang roughneck. Outside of that, I will say that Little Shop of Horrors is one of my favorite musicals ever, like, across any medium. And I will hold reservation for that film. That will tell me if there is a musical renaissance coming. Because if they do dirty by that movie, then all hope is lost for movie musicals. I was on board when Joseph Gordon-Levitt was in talks to play Seymour, And now Taron Egerton is going to be there. I think he's way too good looking to be a Seymour character. And I don't know what they're talking about with Scarlett Johansson potentially playing Audrey in this movie. That seems insane to me. I don't know. Like, she's a pretty good actress, but I don't know. So I am hopeful, but I am doubtful that we are set for a musical renaissance. That's my two cents.
Fair enough. Taron Egerton does have the thing going for him that he can really, really sing. Like
really.
Guy can belt it. And here's the thing, if studios need proof that like musical movies work, I mean, Bohemian Rhapsody and Rocket Man are basically musical movies. They're just only songs by one person. And they did fantastic. Totally. So just make more musicals.
And basically directed by the same person. I will say though that Rocket Man is much more of a musical, if you will. Like, they incorporate the music into kind of the scenes, whereas Bohemian Rhapsody was a little more just like, here we are performing songs kind of thing.
100%. They were both perfectly fine movies and they made lots of money, so Hollywood.
Totally. I love it.
So, funnily enough, In the Heights actually enters into my question, and that is, so a big announcement came out that Infinite, the new film starring Mark Wahlberg, directed by Antoine Fuqua, would premiere exclusively on Paramount Plus. This was apparently a huge surprise to both Mark Wahlberg and Antoine Fuqua, as they were not involved in these negotiations whatsoever, nor was the producer of the film. Similarly, John M. Chu stated he found out about the day and date release of In the Heights 15 minutes before it got announced. This has been a theme running through all of post-COVID or in COVID Hollywood. Is this something we're just going to see with movie negotiations going forward, that you never know until the last minute that your distributor might just like, nah, screw it, we're throwing it on streaming? Or is this a short-lived just kind of vestige of post-COVID movie industry?
Oh, God, I hope it's the latter of that. I feel like we're going to have a lot of like true auteurs and directors that are just refusing to work within the studio system if this continues. We have one of the movies I'm most excited about this year is dropping is Dune. And I'm probably going to butcher his name, but is it Denis Villeneuve?
Yeah, Denis Villeneuve or Denis Villeneuve. Yeah, Villeneuve.
I know. I always feel like I mess it up either time. I'm sorry to him either way, but yeah. he had a similar reaction and was like no, like he had a film already that was brilliant with Blade Runner 2049 that didn't get the studio push behind it that it needed, and it died. And it's not because it wasn't an amazing film. Critically, it was loved by everyone. Fans loved it. Critics loved it. But the problem was people didn't go see it because it didn't have a push from the studio. And here he is now doing essentially the same thing. He's playing in a sandbox that's already been kind of opened before. People have seen. People are very familiar with the Dune property as a novel or as a series of novels. They're also familiar with David Lynch's Dune. So I think what you're going to have is you're going to have these directors, these artists that are going to start refusing to work within these systems if this kind of thing keeps happening, because essentially their movie isn't going to the intended audience. And a lot of times they have this outset, this idea of like, I made this film specifically to be seen this particular way. Now, I'm not saying every director's out there doing it. I'm not saying that David Lynch, director of John Wick, is like, my movie must be seen in the theater on the largest screen possible. I'm sure he's like, yeah, whatever, watch it on a cell phone if you want to, it looks badass no matter how you watch it. But your Christopher Nolans, your Denis Villeneuve's, your you know, these kind of directors, these kind of filmmakers, I think you're gonna start to have them pull away from these systems. And I don't think that that's what Hollywood wants. I think they're going to start to see that hurt their bottom line. So yeah, that's a long-winded way of saying, I really hope that this trend doesn't continue. I hope this was just a bunch of studio executives being like, COVID's happening, baby. This is the wild, wild west. We can do whatever we want right now. Nobody's even caring. Nobody's watching us. And I hope that now, like, structure is regaining, that they're like, maybe we can't just do whatever we want. Let's maybe listen to the filmmakers.
Yeah, and Iggy and I have touched on this a few times throughout on Versus, throughout kind of like this post-COVID world of the movie industry. But there's a lot to unpack here between, like, is it going to completely change the way you negotiate contracts with the movie industries? Because most of these big name directors, the Christopher Nolans, the Denis Villeneuve's, and stuff like that, they get points on the contract. Like, they get points at the box office. If it's not going to the box office, like, that should, is that what happens to that contract? And obviously, it sounds like a lot of these deals are being made without, like, the creatives involved. The other thing is, like you said, when you get out of the movie theater, like, the movie studio system, the big thing is if the movie's just going to get released on streaming anyway, what's to stop me from telling Paramount or Warner Brothers, whoever, to F off? Because I've already noticed my boy, like, between, like, Rian Johnson and all these guys, Apple and Netflix and Amazon are backing truckloads of monies up to guys' houses for exclusivity. And I'm doing a normal movie contract, and then you're just going to dump it on Paramount Plus. No, screw you guys. I'm going to go to Netflix. They're going to back up $1 billion. They're going to back up a dump truck of money, give me total creative freedom, and let me do whatever I want. So if it's going to go to streaming, at least let me get a cut of it. So, and I think Fincher's kind of done that now with Netflix. He's kind of gone that route. He's done a couple movies for them, and just like, you know what, if you're going to treat my movie this way, like, I might as well get paid for it. So, because at least Netflix and Amazon and Apple are like, well, fine, we'll just throw as much money at the wall as we can and get creatives to come do stuff. That movie obviously is the one for me that was the big one too. I mean, if you can't tell, I have an original 1983 Blade Runner poster hanging on the wall right here. My leather-bound copy of Dune is right over here. Like, those nice. Are two things right in my sweet spot. And Denis is quite possibly one of my, if not my number one, top number working directors today, between Blade Runner, Arrival, Sicario, Prisoners, and Cindy's. The guy just makes fantastic movies. Like, I don't know that I've been as excited about a movie that I am about Dune right now. So that was definitely one of those things. But it's like, the movie theaters are going to have to figure something out, because like the creatives, the big name guys that, you know, have enough cachet to just do what they want, will never make another movie for you. It's one of those things where, like, yeah, maybe Paramount Plus bumps a bunch of subscribers by having Infinite on their thing exclusively. But, like, Antoine Fuqua's never going to make a movie for you again if that's how he's going to get treated. You know, he'll just say, like, yeah, no, I'm not going to do that. Same with Mark Wahlberg. Like, you run the risk of alienating the Nolans, the Denis of the world, and then you're just stuck, you know, not having that. You're gonna have to program against them for the rest of their careers. So,
right. No, I totally agree with that. I do think, and this is veering slightly off topic, but still on topic, I think what we're gonna end up seeing is a paradigm shift between these streaming first services, these digital first services, and your classic Hollywood studios, like your, you know, Warner Brothers, for example. I think we're going to start to see that power shift. I went and saw the other day, like him or hate him, I went and saw Zack Snyder's Army of the Dead in the theater the other day, because Netflix struck a deal with several theater chains to play the movie for a week prior to it debuting on Netflix, which was pretty wild to be able to see a Netflix streaming only film in the theater. Was a new experience for me. And I think as theater chains wise up and are saying, you know what, Warner Brothers, it's Sony, etc., Disney, you guys aren't the only names in the game anymore. And we have these other services, your Amazons, your Apples, your Netflixes, that are willing to pay the money for the distribution to get these wider audiences. I think we're going to start to see a pretty hardline shift on kind of that power dynamic that these big studios once had. They're going to start to see that their foundations aren't as solid as they thought.
Yeah. And I think there's another piece of this that people talked about a little bit last year, but it happened right in the middle of the pandemic. So it was one of those things that not a lot of people talked about. But back in August or July of last year, a federal judge struck down the Paramount consent decrees that came out back in like the 40s, which basically said that for antitrust reasons, big movie studios like Warner Brothers, 20th Century Fox, Paramount, couldn't also own the means of distribution, as in they couldn't own movie theaters. That law doesn't really exist anymore. And I think in the post-COVID world, when a lot of these movie theater businesses are going out of, a lot of movie theater companies are going out of business, theaters are closing, I think at some point you may just see they're going to have their streaming services and they're going to release it in theaters, but they're only going to release it in theaters that they own. Like, we already saw kind of Warner Brothers doing that deal with Regal where they have exclusivity for the first like 90 days before it goes, but only in Regal theaters. I think it would not be, I would not be, I mean, right now there's no money to be had in opening a movie theater chain, sure, but I would not be surprised if a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, there's all of a sudden a Paramount line of movie theaters or a Warner Brothers line of, or God forbid, a Disney line of movie theaters, where if you want to see the newest Disney Marvel movie, you got to go see to a Disney owned theater. So
welcome to Disney theaters. I love Disney, but that is a nightmare to me. Yeah, interesting. I love it. Well, that brings me to our last kind of big one of the night. Boom. This was some news that shocked me. G4. Yes, that same G4. You see the logo right down below. Has announced its intent to triumphantly return to all of our nerdy eyeballs. Branding itself as a digital first incarnation and relaunching multiple YouTube channels and web series in its B4 G4 campaign designed to tease and titillate before the official launch, gamers and nerds should probably be rejoicing. That said, do you think that a gaming-based cable channel still has a place in the world where Twitch and YouTube digital content reign supreme?
I don't know. I mean, this is one of those things where you're just cashing in, I think. I mean, unless, until you can build an audience and you can get some people in, you're 100% just cashing in on nostalgia. But I think if anything in the last decade of pop culture has taught us anything, it's nostalgia is big, big, big business. Like, sure, there's a lot of disposable income with people between the ages of 30 and 50 who grew up on these things. So, like, I mean, this kind of like started percolating, I think, last year, because like last year, like Attack of Show and the X Play like reactivated some accounts. They did this weird, like, there was this weird like Thanksgiving reunion thing, if no one watched it, that had like Adam Sessler and Morgan Webb, and they did like this whole like just basically interviewing people and talking about their memories. Olivia Munn, there was buzz a while back that Olivia Munn might be in talks to like make a multi-deal deal with them. So like they've been kind of building to this announcement for a little while. The fact that they are 100% bringing back Attack of the Show, X Play, yeah, putting them digitally, I'm curious to see what that actually means. They've definitely been picking up a lot of digital things. Like there's a Dungeons and Dragons live thing that they're doing that they've announced that's going to be coming out in July. They've talked about some deals with made a deal basically with Comcast and possibly doing some things with like over. I mean, I'm curious to see where it goes. I mean, there's definitely, I don't know if like the word's definitely. There's so, I don't know, gaming journalism has always been in this kind of weird, without like getting too much into the weeds with, you know, weird stuff. Like gaming journalism, sure, has always had lived in this weird place in pop culture and even in gaming culture, whether it be magazines or websites and then streaming this and then the reporter and then that line between publisher and it's always been a very, I don't know, it's always been a really weird world. And when your audience base is quote unquote capital G gamers, there's always going to be stuff attached to it. Yeah. So I don't know. I definitely think there is a market for a version of G4, but almost straight from a nostalgia place and less from a, like, this is where everyone's going to go to get their new game news.
Sure, sure. I totally agree with that. I do have kind of I am in the same boat, but I do have a slightly different opinion. And it's more so just because I think if they brand themselves and pitch themselves correctly, what they could be could absolutely hold a place on television. So here's kind of what I envision. Do I think that what they were when they went off the air is exactly what they can come back as? No, I do not think that as a cable channel that people will pay for and hope for those advertising dollars, I don't think that will be a successful thing. What I do think that they could do is I think they could essentially come back with their nostalgia play of like, hey, here are all these shows that you remember, but they kind of pivot and rebrand themselves almost as like a sci-fi Wire style like network, and they lean more into like gaming and pop culture nerddoms as a whole, as opposed to just being, you know, a gaming first network. I think that could work, and they try to appeal to other niches. That's, in my opinion, that's the way that that channel is successful. Outside of that, I don't necessarily know that I know how it's going to work. I mean, it went off the air for a reason. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of one of those things where it's like, when something stopped working, whatever it was 10 years ago, it doesn't mean that it just because it's 10 years later, you can pick up right where you left off. So, but I think the people involved are smart enough to know that. And so I have a feeling that's what we're going to end up getting. We're going to get like a hybrid gaming channel, but it's also going to be kind of this broad, more broad spectrum nerd culture channel as well.
I accept your point to a point, but I think when you get into weird like niche fandoms specifically, and also into kind of like that nostalgia factor, the whole like you can't just pick up a thing 10 years later and pick up where you started off. I can point to a couple, for instance, Mystery Science Theater 3000 Kickstarters that say differently. Like, there is a market for the right, if you hit the right note, like there is a market for that content. Now, I'm not saying that G4 held the same cultural cachet with fans as Mystery Science Theater 3 is a cultural institution, but I think if you do it, like you said, if you do it right, and if you approach it from the right way, like there is money to be had there. There are eyeballs to be grabbed. So we'll see.
For sure. I mean, I was excited when I read the headline. I was like, all right, like I can get on board with this. I'll see what's going on.
I mean, there. I'm more than happy to listen to Adam Sessler just talk about things on whatever. So
yeah, I totally support that. Well, that brings us to the end of the rounds proper, right? And so
let's do it.
Now,
let's do some quick hits. Let's do it.
Now let's do it. Quick hits.
We're still supposed to, we're going to put some air horns over this graphic. We haven't done it yet. He's saying we're going to do it, but we haven't done it.
I don't ever, and please just keep verbally making the sounds of air horns. I love that. I love that so much. It's so bad. Or just make an audio track of that. Of just air horn, but also say air horns. Like air horns, air horns. Oh, man. Quick hits. All right. Rugrats, the beloved series of 90s kids' childhoods, is back on Paramount Plus, this time in a newly CG animated form. Why does everything have to be rebooted into CG?
Here's the thing. I feel like rebooting things into CG is such a late 90s, early 2000s thing. Like, I don't even feel like it's a today thing. Like, remember when, like, they made, like, was it MTV that made, like, a CG Spider-Man for a minute? That
yes.
Had, like, Neil Patrick Harris. And, like, yes. Or, I mean, it feels like the weird, like, CG reboot. Funny. It just makes me think of the TV show reboot, which in your memory reboot was, like, this super, like, super amazing, like, slick. And you go back and watch it, like,
no.
This is the worst thing I've ever seen. I mean, no, it's still a fantastic show, but, like, the graphics don't live up in your head. It's like when you, like, picture an old video game in your head, then you go back and play it, like, God, this is this is awful. I don't know.
You're talking to the guy who just recently bought Omicron Nomad Soul for his Sega Dreamcast that he just bought and was like, this game is awesome. And then I played it, and I'm like, this game is pretty rough.
I did just buy the Megami Tensei 3 Nocturne, like, remake on Steam the other day. So I'm not going to make judgments. But here's the thing about Rugrats holds a weird place for me because, like, I am of the Nickelodeon generation. I remember the original night that, like, Nicktoons aired. I remember the original night of SNICK because those were big deals. Rugrats, though, came a little bit later. So Rugrats was, like, my little brother and little sister's literally favorite show in the world. I have seen literally every Rugrats episode 100 times because it used to play every morning for an hour before we would leave for, like, it would play at 7 and at 7:30. So before we'd leave for school at 8, you would see two episodes. And that's all we would ever watch for breakfast. So, like, Rugrats is personally fine. I'm a big fan of, like, that Klusky Cuspo company, like animation studio. Yeah. They did some really cool stuff. Class B Cusp, but I think that's right. Anyway, but it was never like my show. My shows were Doug and Ariel Monsters and Ren and Stimpy and Angry Beavers. But yeah, I mean, I don't know why to do it in CG. I feel like CG has come and had its day, and unless you're putting out like Pixar quality CG, just go do 2D animation. It's better.
I don't know. Seth Rogen literally announced yesterday the release date for his new CG reboot of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles coming out in 2023.
I mean, that announcement was really cool, and I'm on board with that, so it's fine.
All right, fair enough. So the takeaway is CG reboots are totally fine as long as it's Seth Rogen rebooting the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Or if the quality that you're delivering to the table is like Pixar level CG. Like if it's sure. If you're going to come to the table with something that's like, God, why did they do? It's just,
Spoiler alert, looks, Rugrats is not.
Yeah, it's going to look plasticky like toys. And then they're going to release toys that look exactly like it. It's going to look like a bunch of Funko. It's going to look like a bunch of Funko Pops walking around because they're babies. They got big heads and small bodies. They're just... It's going to look like Funko Pop television show. And then we'll probably release Funko Pops of them and make millions of dollars. So we'll see.
True.
All right. In nerdy tech news, the bottom pretty much dropped out of the non-fungible token or NFT market today. The value of that kind of like the deals being done on that dropped basically 90% since its peak. I mean, today was kind of like the last thing of it. Is there literally anyone on the planet that is surprised by this?
No. No. The answer is no.
You thought that the market for buying URLs was basically just going to keep going up and up and up?
Forever?
Not really owning the URL, but owning the idea of the URL that may or may not hold an image, a JPEG, basically. I mean, here's the thing. I realize I am simplifying it, but I do understand how NFTs and the blockchain and everything works. I don't know how anyone ever saw this as anything other than a pyramid scam.
Yeah. It honestly, okay, so I didn't understand it at all and had to have a friend, actually Dane from On the Project Nerd Network, CF3 podcast video series on the YouTube channel. Go check it out. Dane had to message me and explain to me exactly what an NFT was and how it worked. And when he did, my initial response was, well, this can't possibly be a lasting thing. Like that sounds implausible to have legs. And he was like, yeah, but right now it's really great. People are making tons of money. And I'm like, okay, well, this is one of those things where you got to see where as Wayne Gretzky would say, you got to see where the puck is going and you have to pull out while you still have buckets of money and you can. So for all those who did that, kudos.
More power to people who got rich off of this, various digital artists and things like that, who made a bucket of money on this. But yeah, I don't know how anyone can actually be surprised by this.
Kevin Smith opened a digital store selling NFTs. Did you see that? He actually is releasing Kilroy Was Here, his latest film, as an NFT. You could buy the film as an NFT. Did you see that? So it's not being distributed. The idea was that whoever built it could or bought it could do whatever they wanted with the film. They could never release it. They could release it, whatever.
The one I remember is Beeple. If people are familiar with Beeple, the digital artist, he's one of those people who's favorite for his, he's famous for his like Instagram series Every Days, where he basically every day for the last like many, many years, like so basically since 2007, he has uploaded a new piece of art on his Instagram, digital art, and became very popular. His Instagram's very popular. He's a very popular digital artist. He made a NFT, basically, collage collection of his first 5,000 of them, and it sold for $69.3 million.
That's so like, crazy!
Like, Mike Winkleman, more power to you. That's fantastic, but I'm sorry for whoever spent $69.3 million on it, because it is definitely not worth that today.
That's crazy. That blows my mind that somebody had $69.3 million and was like, yep, this is what I'm.
But well done. Well done, people, for cashing in on it. So
for sure. Definitely. 1,000%. All right. Moving on. Spider-Man No Way Home. We talked about it earlier. Is set to debut in theaters in December, a mere 7 months from now. When are they going to give us a trailer? Tyler, when?
Give me your prediction. I assume that the trailer will be coming out the weekend of July 9th, if I had to.
Tomorrow? Guess. Did you say by the 9th?
The weekend of July 9th.
Oh, okay.
That is when Black Widow is supposed to hit theaters. Like, I'm assuming that's it. I can't think of anything big that's coming up. Maybe the NBA Finals, like, is the biggest, like, event I can think of coming up. But there's no, like, big Super Bowl. I can't think of any big television event. I doubt that they would release it as in conjunction with, like, a Disney TV Plus show. So I couldn't see it being attached to, say, like, a Loki or something. So if I had to put a date to it, I would say it'll be at the front of the Black Widow movie.
Nice. All right. I hope so, because I'm getting sick of Sony trolling everyone with their trailer hints. Have you seen that? Did you see the photos around?
And
like,
we found the
Spider-Man trailer.
Yeah, and the fact that maybe that they've been toasted, and I get that, like, because of the deal with, it's a, you know, a co thing with Sony and Marvel, maybe I'm way off base on that, but I could definitely see it coming out before July 9th, but I can't imagine it won't. If it hasn't come out before July 9th, it won't come out with the Black Widow movie.
They're just going to release the movie. No trailer for this movie.
strategy.
As
of today, Amazon has announced that Prime Day is coming. It will be here in June, the 21st and the 22nd. Are you someone who annually partakes in the Amazon's Black Friday in July/June?
Nope.
No.
Mm-mm. Nope. Let me tell you a funny story, Tyler. I have always wanted to, but I have always been too poor. And then when it came to the point where I was no longer too poor, I just didn't care. So I don't know how that works, but I only wanted it when I couldn't afford it. And then when I can't afford to do some shopping on it, then I was like, I got other things I could spend money.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's obviously just not unlike Black Friday itself. It's not what it once was. Like those first couple, like there were some deals to be had. Now it's just kind of like, that's not the greatest deal, or it's a limited, whatever. It's like normal Black Friday. It's like, I get that that's a great deal, but that's also like the cheapest possible. Like some company made a knockoff version of their own television to sell just on this day at this price. So
sure. And see, I'm one of those dudes that, like, throughout the year, I'm looking for good deals. Like, that's my heritage. I'm just like, I need the best deal on this. And so I usually pick up things throughout the year. So when this sort of event comes around, I'm kind of like, already kind of got everything I'm looking for. If I do go on there, I'm just going to buy things that I didn't need or want. It's just kind of like, just to buy it because I'm like, ooh, that is very cheap. And I should have that, I guess.
Fair enough. All right, close us out. What's our last hit?
Yeah, here we go. Easy, easy. Cruella just premiered in theaters. I saw it last night. Very good. And is raking in those villainous bucks. Should Disney consider giving standalone gritty origin stories to more of their stable of baddies?
I mean, Emma Stone is on the record of saying that she would like to see an Ursula movie, which, all right. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's something to be said for like telling the other side of the story. Sometimes they're really fascinating. To go back to musical talk, like Wicked is a fantastic musical and it's a really fun retelling of a classic story. The trick is make sure that you're finding a clever end to the story. Cruella was perfectly fine. I can't get over the, I don't want to say origin of the Cruella, but like the tie-in to her eventual movie is like the the impetus for the villain that she becomes in 101 Dalmatians is ridiculous at best and ludicrous at
stretch.
Worst. It's rough. Like that's literally all I can think about having now seen the film. But at the same time, like if you can find an interesting end, if you can find a fun way to tell a story, if you can find a cool way to retell the story from a different perspective that's worth telling, cool, go with it. At least it's not them like just remaking live actions of classic animated films. So but at the same time, Disney, like just make new stuff.
Cool. I'm into it. I enjoyed Cruella. I will tell you this, when it was first announced, I was one of the ones who was like, no, this is stupid. Like, why would you do that? This doesn't matter. I was like that up until the theater. I was like, man, this is going to be dumb. And then I watched it. And I was like, you know what? That was actually a lot of fun. Like, I really enjoyed Emma Stone. I thought the musical choices were awesome. I think the costume designer should win an Oscar, like hands down. The costumes were amazing, even from like the most simple costumes that like Jasper and Horace wore, were really well done. The set design was really awesome. That aside, I know exactly what you're talking about. It was a bit of a stretch, but weirdly enough, I almost didn't care. Like, I enjoyed it as a movie, just as a movie. Like, I was like, if this wasn't tied to 101 Dalmatians, I would enjoy this. This is silly and stupid fun. I don't know what that says. Like, I don't know if that's like a success in Disney's book that they're like, this made them not care about the other movie that this is tied to, or if it just could have been any movie. It didn't have to be Cruella. I don't know. So sure.
I guess. Okay. So at that point we've had Maleficent now, and we've had Cruella. If you have to pick one Disney villain to have their origin story told in film, which one is it? It's tricky because a lot of the really good Disney villains, the movie they're in has their origin story to a point already in it. Like, it's built in to a point to an extent. So
I'm going to go on a weird dive here and stay with me. I want the female, and I don't remember her name for the life of me, but the lady that reminded me of Carol Burnett from The Rescuers. Do you remember that movie?
The original Rescuers, where she lives on an old steamboat.
She's got Snoops, the dude that works for her, and she like kidnaps the kid to steal the teddy bear that has a diamond in it or whatever. I want her in, like, how did she end up living in that houseboat? Because clearly she was like a criminal, like underworld mastermind kind of person. I want to know how that happened. I think she's a weird enough character, and then she's like not fleshed out at all. I think you could do plenty there. And it wouldn't even have to be like an anti-hero movie. Like, I just want to know like her like weird criminal background.
Fair enough. I'm trying to remember. I know that the voice actress was Geraldine Page, who was, in lots of Broadway things, but I don't.
Sure.
Madam something was her name. I can't remember. I know that I remember that Bob Newhart is Bernard and Eva Gabor.
Was it Madam Medusa?
That's it. Madam Medusa. You nailed it. That's
okay.
I just remember that Bob Newhart's Bernard and Eva Gabor was Bianca. And I also am a huge fan of Rescuers Down Under. I love that movie.
Sure.
So good.
Definitely. What about you, if you had to pick one?
Ooh, it's tricky. Like, some of the ones that I feel like would be really interesting would be like too dark for Disney, which is saying something. Like, they would go, like, for instance, now to be fair, he's a character from a classic work of literature, but like of all the like modern Disney villains, one of the darkest, most effed up ones is easily Claude Frollo from The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Oh, sure.
That'd be a really dark one, I think, but it also super would be dark. I don't know there's a way to make that without it coming off as like, we're going to make a movie about the evils of the Catholic Church. So,
Church.
I don't think Disney's going to touch that one. I guess Ursula is a pretty good one. I think that's a fun one. That's a colorful character that probably you could do a lot of fun stuff with. And they're like, because there's a lot of them that are just too one note, too evil for their origin story to be good. Like, no one wants to see the origin story of Gaston. Like, it would be fun for about 5 seconds. Oh, let's tell the story of this misogynist, like, psychopath,
guess what, or, he's been that way since he was a kid. There you go.
There's already been umpteen like origin stories for Captain Hook.
I wouldn't mind a Hades movie.
Hades is fine. The only problem with Hades is like the actual version of Hades in Greek mythology isn't like this nefarious evil terrible bad guy. So
game show host.
I can't imagine Jafar's would be that good, but I would get on board with Ursula. Ursula is my first pick. Let's do that.
All right, Ursula, as long as it's not Melissa McCarthy. That's my only caveat.
Fair enough.
I'm on board without her.
All right. Well, I think we did it, Quill. We did another one. That's fantastic.
I know.
What else is going on in the Project Nerd world? We got some things. We got other things.
We got so much stuff. Literally, we have a podcast dropping every single day. We've got video series on Project-Nerd on YouTube. We literally have This series will be up there weekly. Are you guys a weekly series?
We're bi-weekly. So every Thursday you either get Versus, and every other week you get Versus, or you get
The Last Word.
The Last Word. So Last Word, Versus, back and forth. Perfect. Alternate weeks. But yeah, that's just one of many amazing podcasts on the Project Nerd Podcast Network. We have one coming up new that we've been teasing for a while. It is had a delayed launch, but if, for those of you who have heard me talk about it many times before, the book club for Project Nerd is sort of here. We were supposed to have already talked about our book for May, which was Piranesi by Susanna Clark. Unfortunately, most of the people at Project Nerd who were supposed to get it done haven't finished the book yet. They will finish it soon, I promise. We're going to talk about it. I already have quite a few cool books lined up for upcoming months. We may have to make this every 2 months sort of thing. I don't know. We'll see. Maybe we'll do give everyone 2 months to read it, and at the halfway point, 1 month in, we'll do like a we'll just dive in and just talk about where everyone's at. But I feel like I'm assigning homework for people at this point. Like, hey, everyone finish the book. But we've got a Discord channel. If you go to project-nerd.com/the-book-club, or just type Project Nerd Book Club into Google, you'll find it. Sure. You can go into our Discord channel that I'm in there. I'm one of those people who lives on Discord 24 hours a day, so I'm always there to answer questions and talk about it. But pick up the book, Susanna Clark from Piranesi, read it. Keep your eyes peeled to the Project Nerd feed for that podcast, and keep an eye out for more books that we're going to announce in the near future. So,
I love it. As always, make sure you visit project-nerd.com/podcasts for more of these shows, the book club, so much more. We have some brand new shows starting, one starting in July called Murder, She Joked. It's a true fake crime comedy improv podcast. Wrap your head around that, guys. Literally, we have something for everyone. So please check us out. And until next time, we'll keep thinking of things to fight about, I guess.
Dig it. Thanks for joining us, guys. We'll see you next time.
Peace. Bye.